Who knows? Maybe that chortle in the trees was directed at you. But does the crow mean it? American crows have more than 20 different calls. They're playful, curious, and intelligent. But no one has identified a crow noise that indicates glee at the expense of another creature. It's just a coincidence that the rattle sounds like a laugh. However, crows can play pranks on other animals. There are reports of crows egging on cats to fight and yanking on dog tails for their own amusement. It's called unrewarded object exploration. They aren't pranking for survival. As far as we can tell, it's just for fun. So it seems that crows have something like a sense of humor. But if you hear a chuckle in the tree, they're probably just minding their own business. Probably. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You refuse to see what your lack of words say to me. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Silence makes my fear grow stronger.
Good morning and welcome, Pablo Vimas.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Pablo Vimas is the gardening's manager for Embark Sustainability Society. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. It's a lovely day, a lovely week to be outdoors in the garden. I'm happy to be here to continue chatting about gardening at the SFU campus.
Great. And one of the things you wanted to talk about today was a little different than the usual of talking about being in the garden itself. Students at SFU are interested in gardens and sustainability and programs, and they're often coming to you with really interesting ideas.
That's right. So as the school starts next week, and we usually during the school year, we get lots of interesting ideas and interesting initiatives from students about food security, growing food, climate change and food, and interesting projects are coming up. And then is when sometimes we have to break the bad news to the students about the feasibility of these projects. The idea to grow food in campus is very big because campus has lots of landscape areas, lots of gardening areas. The initiative is just to start a garden somewhere in campus, and we can do during the course they are taking, a course either in public health or sustainability, food systems. And then where it really becomes a bit complicated because they would like to have finished the project during one term or during 6 weeks course.
So this is often students who are taking a course and they want to do this as their sort of course project.
That's right. Yes.
Right. That's where the time constraint comes from.
Indeed. Yeah. So just to more or less explain how it works here in campus is students groups will come with an initiative. Then, of course, you will need a space where to build your project. And most of the times that space needs approval from SFU facilities. So the students have to prepare a full project to be approved by facilities grounds. And then when the approval is come through, you can start building and carry on with the project. But that section of approval, it very much can take over 1 year.
Yeah, I think people don't realize just the amount of bureaucracy and approvals and whatnot, yes, that goes on. It's not just find a square of land and start digging.
Yes. And the other thing is, okay, so you have to get the approval, and then facilities will ask you who is going to keep a long-term maintenance of this garden, who is going to be responsible for that. And most of the times, there is no that thinking. It's like, we just build a garden and then we pass on to embark sustainability. And we as an organization, we are like, well, that is a bit difficult because we don't have capacity. We don't have the money to maintain those gardens and keep going. And so most of the times, those big ideas kind of like go flat because you cannot build in just 1 or 6 weeks or one semester.
I imagine a big constraint too, of course, which perhaps students aren't thinking about is, you know, they're coming to you in October or February or even perhaps May, which might be the best. Mm-hmm. But as we've learned through this conversation all these years, and of course you knew this all the time, it takes a lot of planning and you can't just sort of start any old time and put something in the ground either.
Oh yes, that is another thing. Yes, most of the initiatives come early spring, and they need to be finished by August. So, right. And so it's just during the nice warm season. Mm-hmm. It's about getting the approval from facilities, yep, building the garden, and long-term maintenance. And in our campus, we consider most of the gardening that's happening is rooftop gardening. Mm-hmm. We always have concrete slabs at the bottom, wherever we dig. And as well, it's not easy to dig because there is lots of wires, pipelines. So we really need to go and involve facilities like, can I dig in here? Because always there is something below. So that's one thing. And the other is, okay, so how we bring materials is... Mm-hmm. If there is water nearby, how we are going to bring all the materials to the site, who is going to take care. And sometimes that we tend to forget is about who is using that space when nobody's around, how the space where the garden is installed is operating when no gardener is around, which is as well a thing that we need to consider. It happens that we nowadays we using quite a lot of cell watering garden beds, which means that there is a water reservoir at the bottom of the garden bed.
Yeah.
And then we have people visiting the garden, and they have with their cup of coffee, cup of tea, and they find funny to just pour the coffee or the drinks into the garden bed.
Right.
And it's not something like, oh, yeah, we can clean, we can flush it. No, it involves removing the soil and cleaning the wall reservoir at the bottom because, you know, there is bacteria, fungi that grows because of the sugar in the drinks. So that is one thing that sometimes is overseen, how the space is being used. What we, as environment, we've been encouraging is, okay, you have started the garden in here. We must put a note in there that the produce that is growing in there is consumed to the garden visitor's risk, own risk.
Yeah.
Because liability, you know, if you eat something and you cannot control who pours something in there. And so it's all these other additional things, how the space is used, what could happen to be prepared.
So students are coming to you with a lot of enthusiasm, you know, inspired by the courses they're taking and things they're learning and, you know, their own interests in the environment and sustainability. How are you able to sort of direct them to, or are you able to direct them to something that they can do, you know, that fits into the time frame and, you know, the person hours available, you know, to someone taking a course, you know, are there things they can do in a sort of virtual aspect of planning and, but that may not go all the way to executing?
Yeah. So most of the times everything just goes as a writing down a project, but not executing the project. And sometimes they would like to execute the project. And I, as a manager of the gardens, I try to help them within my possibilities. For instance, last spring, we had someone interested in growing herbs, start a herb garden indoors. And so I met with the person and explained how the garden indoors works. And I provided the plants because the student would like to start from seeds, which seeds will take 5 to 6 weeks to germinate.
Right.
And her work project was in 6-8 weeks. So most of the project will be just in the hoping that the seeds germinate. So the idea was, okay, you can start your in herb garden indoors. I provide the plants that we have in our garden, and you can just start with growing up plants. So you really have the experience on harvesting or maintaining, and less experience about growing the seeds.
Excellent. So this is it's obviously a much more, well, we know running a garden is actually a pretty busy, complicated business if you want to be generally successful. And I don't mean, you know, as we've learned through these discussions over these years, you know, you're starting your process for your annual gardens in January with seedlings and, you know, planting in the spring and harvesting and then planting again and harvesting and planting again. And even as we go into the fall, we're going to be planting this fall for things that, you know, that are going to come up again. So it's really a complicated process that can't be really shrunk down, but Embark does have programs that students can get involved with that aren't necessarily quite the full year cycle, but are going to get them started in the garden. And maybe you can tell me a bit about that because you have some coming up for the fall.
Yes. So as Embark, we ran 3 gardening cohorts in spring and in fall. Each gardening cohort is 6 weeks. In the summer, we have a gardening cohort running for 10 weeks. And during those, we meet once a week. And that in each gardening session, we talk about agricultural practices, experiences that we have, the attendees, the participants, as well as the shared experiences. And then we have a hands-on practice. So each participant have a garden plot to maintain, a 4x4 is feet garden plot that they will be maintaining, means planting, watering, harvesting, replanting during that time. So that kind of complements the learning theoretically and as well practical activities with how to run a garden. And then, yes, most of the time is we have a curriculum that we follow. Mm-hmm. And it's 1.5 hour, 1.5 hours a week, plus the 1 hour that the participants come to visit the garden on their own time.
Right. And what is sort of the learning outcome for that? What can students expect to take away from at the end of the session?
At the end of the session, students will be confident in how to plant seeds, the right way, how to transplant. So don't be afraid to handle plants. As well, there are different styles of gardening, styles of planting seeds and distributing your crops in the garden bed, how to harvest properly to prevent contamination or by bacteria or fungi for the produce that you are harvesting. So food safety as well in the garden. And later as well, we explore what you can do with the produce that you've been harvesting. So for instance, at the moment for the fall is very much focused on food preservation and conservation.
Right. Great. Yeah. And of course, for participants to get all those benefits, they really need to stick with it through the program, though. They got to be, commit some time in their schedule with, in addition to school and everything else, eh?
Yes, that's correct. So unfortunately, plants don't take a break. And being a farmer or a gardener, you need to be committed. You cannot just say, I will water the plants next week. No, the plants don't wait. The plants have to be watered today. If I have one thing that I say to the participants, if you don't harvest right now, nature will do it for you. Yeah. And it's very common that they say, let's leave this tomato. And by the next week, the tomato is gone. And of course, you are sad because you should have harvested a week before when it was ready. Yeah. So it's commitment to the time, commitment to visit the garden, and committed to is a commitment. The garden needs to be visited, and the garden needs to be watered, needs to be harvested, and has to be done. Yeah. So
right. Well, how do people get a hold of you, either to talk about something they want to do for their school project, or to get involved in your gardening cohort?
So our gardening cohort, we are at the moment doing the promotion through our social media channels, so you can look for Embark Sustain. You can visit our website as well under events. We have as well events in there where you can see what's happening in the garden, or you can just contact me directly to my email, gardens@embarksustainability.org.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Pablo.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. We'll be back next week to talk gardens again here on Gardening with Embark. Thanks for joining me today.
My name is Magnus Teeville. Joining me today is Peter R.H., and you're going to talk about David Orchard.
Now, David Orchard was an activist who was against the NAFTA, a North American Free Trade
Canadian
Agreement.
Canadian activist.
He was a Canadian activist, yeah. Sorry. And then he was actually against the other agreement that came before that, was just between the United States and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
He attempted to become leader of the Progressive Conservative Party in 1998.
Right.
I think he tried again And then what I think it was 2003. Mm-hmm. And then that didn't happen, obviously. And then they became the Alliance, and
yeah,
it sort of merged. One thing is that the legality is that the present Conservatives, which is Pierre Poilievre, is the leader.
Yeah.
That is not technically the Conservative Party, which was originally under John Macdonald.
Yeah.
He was a Conservative, and then they chose to rename it. Not so much rename it, just say Progressive Conservative.
Yeah, well, I think there's a thing in the 20s where there is a Progressive Party and then the Conservatives, and at some point they merged to become the Progressive Conservatives, which is how they ended up being called that.
Well, what it is that even when they were by that name, they could legally go back to John A. Macdonald.
Yeah,
right,
there's
now, yeah,
continuity, right? Because they merged and carried forward with the same organization.
So so David Orchard...
just to finish your point, so what you're sort of commenting on is that the current Conservative Party, because of course... there were the Progressive Conservatives and then the Reform, and all the politics and Reform sort of took
Alliance
over.
Alliance was one of them.
And then, yeah, took over as the dominant party of the right. And the Progressive Conservatives carried on for a while. Didn't they sort of do a bit of a... my recollection of it is they did a sort of dirty merger where they merged with the Progressive Conservatives with a lot of promises, and then once they sort of absorbed the party, they just ignored all that and just carried on.
What I saw, I guess this was a bit, I don't know, I wanted to see David Orchard speaking, and I got a 2009 interview in Victoria. I guess you remember used to have Channel 10 local, I guess it's now defunct to have those community stations.
Yep.
But it was an all-hour interview I saw last night just to review things. He said that basically he was promised that they wouldn't have the merger, and they wound up having it.
Yeah.
But what was going on, it was really 1994, he brought out his book that was against... NAFTA, which was a done deal. The other thing, when I talked a few weeks back about Al Gore and some of the things I'm a bit critical of him, and why a lot of people are sort of, you know, they say, well, he's for climate change, and he seems a bit screwy and all that. What I forgot to bring up David Orchard, because I always thought it was very odd how Al Gore was the promoter of NAFTA. And it's not famous now, but it was famous 30 years ago. It was the debate on Larry King Live between, he lost, he was the third party, Ross Perot, and Al Gore was vice president. They had a debate about NAFTA.
Yeah.
And in the interview I saw in the 2009 interview, I saw... what David Orchard was bringing up, some of the bad things about NAFTA, he said at the time of 2009, Ontario and Quebec wanted to have legislation against doing cosmetic spraying of pesticide. That's only cosmetic.
Right.
And the United States Corporation, DuPont, actually... stopped it because, but by Chapter 11 of the NAFTA agreement,
right?
So there's a lot of consequences of it. And one thing he mentioned,
and just to clarify, Chapter 11 was sort of the foreign investors protection, where if some investors from out of the country felt that regulations were going to negatively impact them, they could complain about that and get things blocked. I mean, that's sort of a very simplified sort of explanation, but that's what they were using. So that an American company could basically protest and prevent Canadian governments from passing certain kinds of legislation. So, sorry.
Yes. It's good that you clarified it, because I... now, the other thing you mentioned in this 2009 interview is that there's been examples of Canadian... corporations doing the same thing in the United States, but he says it mainly happens the other way around because the United States has a bit more power than we in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that during the 1990s, we got Jean Chrétien elected as prime minister.
Yeah, Jean Chrétien.
Yeah. Was a majority government, I think. Yeah. Didn't he? Yeah. He and there was something you don't hear a lot of talk about. It's called the Washington Kingdom Census.
Mm-hmm.
And what and a lot of this is specifically, it's a specific thing. It's the idea that the Federal Reserve and the World Bank and the IMF, who has offices at Washington, D.C. I think the head office of the World Bank is in Washington, D.C., right. Even though it's international, it's part of the United Nations system, the IMF, part of the United Nations system. So what the Washington Consensus, originally the concept was, out of those three bodies, like in a sense they were, the World Bank and the IMF were working with the Federal Reserve to prop up the American greenback, in a sense. Mm-hmm. That it was the globalism, the internationalism, the privatization that was going on around the world was backing U.S. interests. And Jean Chrétien, I think, was seen as part of that. And mm-hmm. that was part of the APEC protest 1997, when the head from Indonesia, Suharto,
yeah.
who was a torturer, and they said, oh, well, it's just an economic meeting, and there mm-hmm. was a protest, and then he was elected out.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways...
Sorry, who was elected out?
The person in Indonesia,
oh, okay.
Suharto.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting. They made a big deal. He had his bodyguards there and everything.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of why I think David Orchard had the concept to try to become a member, the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, to remake it, because what was called liberal, he wasn't agreeing with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where he was coming from.
Yeah.
And he wasn't successful, but anyway.
All right.
Okay, so next week I'm live.
Yes. All right. Well, okay. Do you know what you're going to talk about?
I'll spring something on.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Peter R.H. We'll be back to more here on Speak Up.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you're worried about floods in your street or power outages on your block, there's a good chance that your next-door neighbor is too. And if disaster strikes, people who live close by can often help each other out. So the City of Edmonton and Alberta, Canada, is working to get neighbors talking about climate change and preparing together.
It could be as simple as planting some native plants or getting an emergency preparedness kit together, collecting contact information. It might be knowing who doesn't have air conditioning and going to check in on them. It might be about sharing different resources, making sure people have water that they need.
That's Sarah Danahy of O2 Planning and Design. Her firm worked with Edmonton to create the Neighboring for Climate Toolkit. It's a deck of cards that anyone can download for free. Each card describes an action that neighbors can work on together to reduce global warming or prepare for its impacts, like planting trees or making an emergency plan. So the deck can be used as a conversation starter to help neighbors identify common concerns and interests.
The toolkit is really meant to inspire and spark that first action between neighbors to do things together.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious? Sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.